Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 17th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on TikTok Incorporated versus Garland, which was decided earlier today by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than her career would deserve. So if you're interested, I highly recommend you check out her impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Darpana Sheth, who is a public interest litigator specializing in cutting-edge constitutional cases, protect free expression, property rights, economic liberty, and other individual liberties. She most recently served as the Vice President of Litigation for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression for 4 years. Before FIRE, Darpana was a senior attorney with the Institute for Justice, where she also served as the director of the Institute's National Initiative to End Forfeiture Abuse. She has testified before the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, state legislatures, the Council of the District of Columbia, and before the Judicial Conference Advisory Committees on proposed amendments to procedural rules in federal courts. Her opinions and views on legal issues have been featured in major outlets, including CNN, The Washington Post, Forbes, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. And before becoming a public interest attorney, Darpana served as Assistant Attorney General for the state of New York and worked in private practice as a litigation associate in the Manhattan law firm of Chadbourne & Park, LLP. And I'll leave it there. A last note before we head into a time of opening remarks. If you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that extended portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Darpana, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that kind introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here to talk about this important case. With the so-called TikTok ban set to take effect this Sunday, all eyes and ears were on the court as it was poised to release its much anticipated decision. This morning at 10 a.m. in an unsigned opinion, the court upheld the federal law that would conditionally ban TikTok in the United States if the applications, if the app's Chinese parent company, ByteDance, did not sell its U.S. assets. So notably, the court assumed, without deciding, that as a threshold matter, the law triggered First Amendment scrutiny. And I'll dive into this aspect in a little more detail later. But the takeaway here is that if the court decided the law did not trigger the First Amendment, then that would have sort of been the end of the analysis, the end of the case. The court then concluded that the challenged provisions were content-neutral regulations, meaning that they're not regulations that targeted the content of the expression. If it had been, that would have triggered the highest level of scrutiny, strict scrutiny, meaning the law would have had to be narrowly tailored to further a compelling government interest. But because the law is content-neutral, the court applied intermediate scrutiny and ruled that it satisfied the standard because the law furthered the government's important interest in protecting Americans' data from a foreign adversary. Justices Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch issued separate concurrences. But before we get into kind of the details there at the outset, I wanted to note how narrow the court's opinion is. And it's really limited to the unique facts in this case. There were a lot of amicus brief, a lot of interest in this case on all sides. And I think that the court did a good job in really narrowing its ruling to the unique facts of this case. For one, you know, the court notes that it involves, quote, new and transformative technology. It's a case that involves a app that's owned and controlled by an undisputed foreign adversary, therefore implicates grave national security concerns. And it involves a largely unprecedented regulation. This act of forcing divestiture is without precedent in previous years. And it's the culmination of 5 years of the government's efforts to address this national security problem involving two separate administrations. And then, of course, you have the whole procedural history involving a very expedited consideration. At several places, both in the court's opinion and Justice Gorsuch's concurrence, they emphasize that the court had just 2 weeks to review the briefing, hear arguments, and decide the case. So with that background, let's look a little more closely at the facts, which are integral to the opinions issued today. So for those who might not know, TikTok is a social media platform that was launched in 2017. It has over 170 million users just in the United States and over a billion users worldwide. And on TikTok, people create and publish videos that can be overlaid with audio or text. So it's an expressive medium. Its parent company is ByteDance, which is a Chinese company that owns the platform's proprietary algorithm. Now, that algorithm is, you know, I guess the secret sauce. It recommends videos to a user based on the user's interactions with the platform. Now, under Chinese law, ByteDance is required to share its data and assist and cooperate with the Chinese government's intelligence work. And therein lies the national security concerns. Now, the court devotes quite a few pages to detailing the background of this law that involved 5 years of the federal government trying to address the concern that TikTok automatically captures vast swaths of information from its users. That information includes the names, ages, phone numbers, phone contacts, social network connections, precise location, internet addresses, the device used, the content of the messages, and even keystroke patterns. And so in the 5 years leading up to this law, you had in August 2020, under President Trump, there was an executive order to basically do the same kind of thing and require protection of Americans' data. And there was years of negotiation with the executive branch to resolve these national security concerns. Those negotiations stall, and it never resulted in any kind of final agreement. On the heels of that, Congress enacts the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, which is the law at issue here, and it requires the divestiture of TikTok within 270 days of the act's passage. The act excludes, importantly, applications, other apps, that have the primary purpose of posting product, business, or travel information and reviews. The case at present is basically two cases. They're consolidated cases, one brought by TikTok and ByteDance, and the other brought by a group of TikTok users and creators. And these petitioners claim that the federal law, as applied to them, violates the First Amendment. Now, the D.C. Circuit upheld the law on applying strict scrutiny, and the chief judge there, Judge Srinivasan, concurred in that result, but would have upheld the law under intermediate scrutiny. The court granted cert in this case on December 18th and held oral argument last Friday, January 10th. And basically, before the court, it had three options: either you can strike down the law, uphold the law, or stay the law, which is one of the amicus briefs that was filed by the incoming President Trump, to stay the law to give the administration a little more time to try to work out some kind of deal. Now, the threshold question in this case is whether the challenge provisions are even subject to the First Amendment. Now, here the court assumes, but doesn't decide, that the First Amendment is implicated. In a footnote, the court clarifies that to the extent any clarification is even needed, foreign entities operating abroad do not have First Amendment rights. So any expressive activity by ByteDance that's occurring abroad is not protected by the First Amendment. And that's an important point that distinguishes, I think, a lot of the other hypotheticals and things that were brought up in oral argument. Next, the court notes that there are at least two ways in which the First Amendment could be implicated and therefore trigger heightened scrutiny. Without that, a law must only be rationally related to a legitimate government interest. So the first way that petitioners argue is that the law regulates expressive conduct, So listeners might be familiar with the O'Brien standard. This was the case of U.S. versus O'Brien, which upheld the law criminalizing the burning of a draft card under intermediate scrutiny, because, you know, the burning of the draft card is expressive conduct. Now, the court rejects this argument, saying it's not clear that the act itself directly regulates protected expressive activity. The law doesn't regulate TikTok users at all, and it's only regulating the corporate control of TikTok. And petitioners, quote, have not identified any case in which this court has treated a regulation of corporate control as a direct regulation of expressive activity or semi-expressive conduct. And the court hesitates to break that new ground in this unique case. So again, the court highlighting what a unique case this is and, you know, kind of limiting its holding. It's worth noting that the government's brief points out that under the petitioner's argument, if you have any law that implicates expressive activity, then if that triggers heightened scrutiny, then you would also, for example, antitrust laws could be enforced against social media companies, and those laws would be subject to heightened First Amendment scrutiny just because it triggers, it affects the social media companies and their expression. The second way that petitioners argue that the law triggers First Amendment scrutiny is that the law imposes a disproportionate burden on protected expression. And there's a number of facets to this. It burdens the generation of content. It burdens the moderation of content. It burdens access to a distinct communication medium. It burdens the expressive association rights, so the right to associate with specific speakers, and it burdens the right to receive information and ideas. And the court notably finds that it has recognized all of these facets as protected First Amendment interests. Importantly, the court says, and I quote, an effective ban on a social media platform with 170 million U.S. users certainly burdens those users' expressive activity in a non-trivial way. But the court notes that it has not articulated a clear framework for determining when regulation of non-expressive conduct that disproportionately burdens those engaged in expressive activity triggers heightened review, and it declines to do so in this case. And so again, the court is emphasizing the narrowness of its ruling. It specifically says that a law targeting foreign adversaries' control over a communications platform is in many ways different than the kind of regulations of non-expressive activity that the court has subjected to First Amendment scrutiny. So those, it highlights two specific differences here. First, you have a congressional determination that the entity is a foreign adversary. And second, you have a link of causal steps between the regulation and the alleged burden. And both of those points, I think, are significant for future cases or what that means in future First Amendment cases. On the first point, at oral argument, I think petitioners raised a couple of hypotheticals, including one or a couple of counterfactuals, I should say, including one about how Politico is owned by a German company and then other examples of foreign-owned media or communication companies. But that this case involves an undisputed foreign adversary that's backed by the record and years of deliberation by coordinate branches of the federal government is a distinguishing feature. So, you know, we're not concerned about Germany or German-owned companies and what they might do with American data in the same way we are with a foreign adversary like China. Second, the important takeaway there is that the court's concern over the causal chain. A lot of the focus in the briefing and at oral argument was that the burdens on protected expression are, in fact, because of China's policies and actions, not the regulation itself. And that concern over a causal chain in kind of the First Amendment context has popped up last term and, you know, over and over again in these social media cases. So last term, listeners might recall in Murphy versus Missouri, the court was concerned that the censorship alleged or challenged in that case about social media platforms was the result of social media platforms themselves and their policy decisions, not any actions by the government. So that's the recurring theme that we may see in future cases. Now, Justice Sotomayor concurred and focused on kind of criticizing the court for sidestepping this decision instead of saying clearly that the act triggers First Amendment scrutiny. She criticizes the court for just assuming that without deciding it. She says the court's own cases make clear that the First Amendment is implicated, and that's absolutely right, as the court itself acknowledges. You know, it acknowledges that the editorial decision, the moderation of content, access to a distinct communication medium, the expressive association, all of those are recognized First Amendment rights, and it cites those cases. But Justice Sotomayor fails to address kind of the court's distinctions that it draws about why this case is different than those cases. And so for those of us concerned with protecting free expression, I think that's an important limiting principle of this decision. So now that the court assumes that the law triggers First Amendment, it needs to decide whether the law targets speech based on its message or its content, or whether the law is content neutral. It rules that the law is facially content neutral. The law is actually targeting the corporate control by a foreign adversary. It does not target speech based on content. It does not regulate speech that's based on the function or purpose. And third, it does not restrict, penalize, or burden speech because of its content. And we know that because the petitioners can't avoid the regulation by simply altering their speech. So if the algorithm was still allowed from the Chinese government and TikTok is divested, they could still say all of the pro-Chinese speech that was on there, or they could still say everything that's being said on TikTok now. It's not about the content. The petitioners argued also that the law was content-based on its face because of that exclusion, the exclusion for apps that are primarily designed for product and business reviews or travel information. But the court notes that this is because this is an as-applied challenge by petitioners, it doesn't need to decide whether that exclusion is content-based. Now, I'm not sure if that's exactly right. I feel like there's some mental gymnastics going on there. And I think Justice Gorsuch's concurrence alludes to this point that you know, maybe it is, in fact, the law is, in fact, content-based. So I'll get to that in a bit. But for the time being, the court notes that this law is at least supported by a content-neutral justification, and that justification is preventing China from collecting vast amounts of personal sensitive data from the 170 million U.S. TikTok users. And that purpose is completely unrelated to the content of expression. The law doesn't reference the content of speech on TikTok, and it doesn't reflect disagreement with the messages on TikTok. And the court rejects the idea that the specific provisions about TikTok should trigger strict scrutiny because it's a restriction based on the identity of the speaker. Again, the court emphasized the narrowness of its ruling, which kind of goes to show that you couldn't use this ruling to justify all efforts to protect data. Of course, data protection and you know, privacy issues are rampant in social media and online. And so I think the court's very careful to note that it's not saying that kind of justification would justify any regulation of speech, but that this case is unique. It focuses on TikTok scale and its susceptibility to control by a foreign adversary that makes this justification okay in this circumstance. The court also rejects the argument that the act is under-inclusive because of that exclusion provision. The court finds that the government had a good reason to single out TikTok because of its history. I think the record is very clear about the way TikTok has handled American data, and how it's shared that data. And the court also notes that the government is not required to address all aspects of a problem in one fell swoop. So it can target the problem imposed by TikTok and then address maybe separately other issues. Like, I think one of the examples that came up in oral argument was Temu and other Chinese-owned websites that that might also be collecting data. Finally, the court finds that the law is sufficiently tailored. So there is an important government interest in protecting Americans' data. And that interest is sufficiently furthered by this law. Under intermediate scrutiny, the law does not need to be the least speech restrictive means. And that's a crucial distinction, because if the court had found that strict scrutiny applied, then it would need to make that determination that this law was the least speech restrictive means. It also notes that it's a conditional, not outright ban. So the TikTok could, just as long as it was divesting itself of foreign control, then everything would be okay. The court also addresses the alternatives posed by petitioners, like disclosure requirements or restrictions on data sharing, and found that those alternatives don't undermine the conclusion that the law is not substantially broader than necessary. And finally, the court addresses the government's other rationale, which is preventing the covert manipulation of content. It rejects, declines to consider this rationale, finding that the law would have been passed anyway. Congress would have passed the law overwhelmingly just because of the data protection rationale. And the court notes that it's an open question as to what is the appropriate level of scrutiny when you have a mixed justification. So that's another important takeaway, that, it's an open question that might have to be addressed by the court at a later time in another case. Now, as I mentioned, Justice Gorsuch issued a concurrence. He has a great line at the top of it. He makes four points. One is that he's pleased that the court rightly refuses to consider that the government's rationale about content manipulation, echoing Justice Harlan from the seminal decision of Cohen versus California. He says, one man's covert content manipulation is another's editorial discretion. And of course, editorial discretion is protected by the First Amendment. He also notes that the court rightly refuses to consider classified evidence. That was an important thing that was also brought up at oral argument. The government below introduced a lot of classified evidence that was not privy to the petitioners in this case, and their serious due process concerns by doing that, in which one party doesn't have access to the information. So the court was right to reject that classified evidence or not consider it in making this ruling. And third, Justice Gorsuch raised serious concerns about whether the law is content neutral and therefore escapes strict scrutiny. I think that goes to kind of a heart of an issue that was not decided by the court, kind of determining the level of scrutiny that applies, where you have Justice Sotomayor and her concurrence saying, well, we should have decided that this triggered First Amendment scrutiny, period, based on the court's decision. And then Justice Gorsuch saying that he would have applied strict scrutiny, and that the law does and would have upheld the law under that heightened scrutiny, under strict scrutiny, because the law serves a compelling interest and that it is narrowly tailored to serve that interest. So that's just a wrap up, I guess, of the court's decision. I see we got a couple of questions here. It's a matter of full disclosure. As I was formerly involved with both FIRE and IJ, they both submitted an amicus brief in this case and argued that strict scrutiny should apply and that the TikTok ban should be invalidated as a violation. I think there are some, I sympathize with the concerns that a lot of folks have that sometimes national security is just invoked as a talisman to justify speech restrictions. And in my own personal capacity, I kind of agree with the court's concern about this. I think the record's very clear here. We're not dealing with just the invocation of national security. You have a 5-year period of Congress and the federal government, both under two separate administrations, trying to deal with this. And I think the court is respectful and notes in its opinion that it owes a certain amount of deference to its coordinate branches. I mean, they're not going to be experts on the national security issue. That said, I think that is an important thing that could distinguish this case from other efforts where it is just sort of national security is just invoked as a talisman, as kind of a magic phrase to justify speech restrictions or restrictions on other civil liberties.
Got it. Thank you. That's all very, very helpful. Really appreciate the summary of the opinion and how we got here, as well as the concurrences. You've already transitioned us into Q&A. So here I'll issue a reminder to our audience that if you do have questions, you can submit those via the Q&A feature, and I'll pick up the next one. It relates to this question of scrutiny. Obviously, that was raised in this case, and that is also being raised in other cases this term, like a Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. This case, very clearly, narrowly tailored. The justices tried to avoid making any broad precedent. But do we get a sense of what their position might be in that case based on how the justices broke out on what level of scrutiny applied here?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say. I think it's hard to say. If folks listen to the argument, I guess it was on Wednesday, in Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, that involved a Texas law about adult content online, and that basically tried to restrict that content for minors and impose an age verification system. So there were some interesting colloquies and exchanges during that oral argument about the level of scrutiny. The central issue presented by that case is what is the level of scrutiny that should apply. There's a precedent, Ginsburg versus New York, in which the court applied a rational basis kind of scrutiny, and that's what was applied by the Fifth Circuit. But there's a whole line of contrary precedent, like five or more cases in which the Supreme Court has applied strict scrutiny. And I think the distinction is going to come down to whether the court finds that in Ginsburg, was the court only looking at the rights of minors to access the information, the adult content, or was it concerned about the burden on adults being able to access that. And so I'm optimistic. I think that the court will apply a more heightened level of scrutiny there because, you know, just given its precedent, but there was a lot of back and forth about, well, times have changed since then. And what does the new technology say about content moderation? And can we really, you know, the world is not the same as it was back when the court decided this in Ashcroft a couple of years ago or several years. Well, I don't forget now how many years ago. This is definitely a long time ago, like a decade ago now. And a lot has changed. I think Justice Barrett made the point that, you know, the iPhone wasn't even around when those cases were decided. So it'll definitely be an interesting case to follow and see what happens.
Got it. Continuing on with that. Obviously, as you mentioned, this is a very narrowly tailored case, but it is coming up in the context of Free Speech Coalition and cases like our NetChoice cases from earlier. How, if at all, does it interact with those cases, and what might that mean moving forward for free speech on the internet / free speech and digital media platforms?
I do think that this case is kind of a one-off. There's so many ways the court takes pains to go out of its way to illustrate how narrow its ruling is, the specific facts that it's using to base its upholding of the law. And I think it's going to be hard to try to export this ruling to other contexts where you don't have that national security issue, where you don't have the long history or record of federal government, both other branches of government, determining that this is a foreign adversary. I mean, there's no dispute. I think the government's reply brief does a great job of saying, you know, there's no dispute that China's been interested in, you know, amassing a bunch of sensitive data about Americans and engaging in malign influence operations. And so when you have that as a backdrop, I think it's really hard to kind of translate that to other contexts. So I'm optimistic that this will be a very limited ruling cabin to the unique facts of this case.
Got it. Well, two questions coming out of that. First one, focusing on the history that the court mentioned of how we got this law and how we got to where we are. And then one on the national security side of things. And the court spent a fair bit of its opening in what is a very fairly short opinion, highlighting the history of both the administrative slash executive work on this side, and then Congress coming to pass a law. Is there anything worth noting in that, especially since the court notes two different administrations were working on this and we're on the cusp of a new administration now?
Yeah, I think, it highlights the deference, I think, that the court is giving here, given the record that you have two different administrations, under Trump and, arguably three, it depends on how you count, but the former Trump administration, then the Biden administration, and we'll see what the incoming Trump administration does. But the record of, you have a history of ByteDance sharing the data, the China's influence and efforts, it's been documented. So I think all of those things go to sort of the narrowness of this decision and why it's hopefully can be cabined to in a way that's not going to undermine free speech protections. I think the Roberts Court has been very protective of free speech and free expression, and I'm optimistic that's going to continue and that this is sort of just a one-off because of the unique circumstances in this case.
Got it. Question continuing on with that. In some cases, and this is an audience question, so I'm going to read it directly and ask me if I need to reread anything. In some cases, like university speech policies, especially by its response teams, courts have decided cases weren't ripe because the government indicated it wouldn't enforce the law as written. Both the Biden and Trump administrations had said they wouldn't enforce this law as it's written. Could the court therefore have declined to decide this case? Or could the decision be helpful precedent for other speech cases where the government says they're just not going to enforce the law?
I think the latter is probably true, or at least I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic that the court will use it in that way. Because, the incoming president, President Trump, filed an amicus brief in this case, specifically asking the court to just stay the law, not address it, because, he wanted to come in and kind of broker some kind of deal. And the court, by issuing the decision today, rejected that, at least implicitly. So I think just because an administration says it won't enforce a law doesn't really provide grounds for the court to evade its duty. It's constitutional duty to decide a case in which it has jurisdiction over it. And I think this case might be a little bit different because even though the administration has but the Biden administration or even the Trump administration has said they won't enforce the law, the facts in this case are a little bit different. So, for example, the fines here, if folks don't comply with the law, they're assessed per user. They could easily be billions of dollars. And the statute of limitations here is 5 years. So that would extend beyond even the Trump administration. So understandably, Google or Apple, may not want to allow the app in their stores come Sunday because of liability concerns that they might face, 5 years from now. So I think, in an abundance of caution and sort of, not wanting to face that kind of liability based on just representations of the incoming administration that they won't enforce it, that doesn't solve the liability concerns, I guess.
Got it. Well, we've had a couple questions on this. What does this mean for TikTok in the immediate future?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think the act does provide the president the authority to delay implementation of the act, basically grant an extension of no more than 90 days. But I think it's an open question whether the president can grant that extension after the 278-day period has run out, which is on Sunday. So certainly President Biden could today or tomorrow grant that extension. But I think it's a question as to whether incoming President Trump can grant that extension retroactively after that period has run out. As a practical matter, I don't I would guess, my best guess, though I don't have all the business details, you know, certainly information, but I would guess that the app goes dark on Sunday and then just wait to see what the president, incoming President Trump does on Monday or this week after.
Do we have clarity as to what the options are for the executive branch, given that this is a law passed by Congress, given and the sort of the competing potential interests there?
Right. I don't think we do. We do know that, I guess, at least it was about 5 years ago when the President Trump tried to do the executive order to kind of do this, that was considered to be outside, you know, outside the scope of his authority to do just as the president. So if you have a law now that does it and then the president's trying to undermine that or without congressional acquiescence or approval, I think it is an open question. So it's a very interesting case just from the point of view of like how the different branches work together and what their roles are in something like this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, especially as we have so many changes and deadlines coming up in the next, even just over this weekend. It'll be interesting to see. Moving to the sort of national security side of things, recognizing this is cabined, how might it shape future conversations on national security in the digital age and how government can pursue that? And I'll add a secondary question to this of, does it matter that it was Congress that did something versus the executive branch that did something in that conversation?
To take the last part first, yes, I think it absolutely matters that it wasn't just Congress. It was Congress and two prior administrations that were trying to resolve this. And I think, you know, as I mentioned before, the court points that out in its opinion that especially in an intermediate scrutiny, when you're applying intermediate scrutiny, that the government deserves some kind of deference for that and two coordinate branches of government coming to those conclusions. Could you repeat the first part of the question again?
Oh, just how does this play into the larger conversation on national security, digital aid, what the government can do to sort of ensure that or pursue that?
I think, you know, in the speech context, when the regulation infringes protected expression, I think, yeah, I guess we'll have to see. I mean, I don't know if there's an analog to TikTok. I mean, certainly there could be other companies that come out. So I think when the facts are very similar, when you have a foreign adversary, like I don't think if you had like the Politico, for example, or if you had some Canadian owned media company or social media application, I don't think you'd be able to assert or get, or the government would be able to assert or get around the national security or the speech restrictions just by asserting national security. I think the court should and would take a closer look at those concerns and say why, you know, if all of a sudden the president decided that Canada was no longer an ally but a foreign adversary, that would be subject to more judicial skepticism than I think the current record in this case and why applied to China. So and maybe that's one just at least cautiously optimistic. I'm at least hopeful that that's the case.
Got it. On that, other than the impact for TikTok and potentially app stores, what, if anything, is the immediate impact of this decision, especially given our sort of the narrowness of the decision? Are there other apps or other things that should at least be taking note? Does anything change?
I'm sure that it does. I don't know. I'm not a TikTok user, I guess, full disclosure. I don't know what other apps are out there that are owned by foreign adversaries. I don't think there are, which is why the court was so focused on that. And parties and the amici and the court all noting that this is a very unique situation. And they'd have to kind of take a closer look at anything. And of course, the speed at which this case was decided was another kind of reason for warranting caution and issuing a very limited decision and a very narrow ruling. So in terms of an immediate effect on other apps or other things, I think the takeaways are more like to keep an eye on the things that the court noted were undecided. So, for example, the framework that should apply when Congress has a mixed justification for a law, or when a regulation is impacting, I guess, sort of indirectly speech, in this kind of national security context. Because otherwise, it's very clear under Moody and other precedent that the court itself acknowledges, if a law regulates conduct, even if that conduct does not have an expressive aspect to it, but if the law disproportionately burdens protected expression, and whether that's the access to a communication or whether it's the expressive association, then that is subject to intermediate scrutiny. And that's a lot of what the amici, including a lot of the amici, had pointed out as well. So I think that's an important distinction.
Got it. Do we have a sense of the downstream effects that we may get? It may be too early to tell, but given that this happened, it's been playing out over the better part of a year at this point in the conversations, both in the lower courts and up to the Supreme Court. Do we know sort of what the downstream effects may be for other industries and to that as well in a highly globalized world? What does this precedent maybe mean for international companies that are thinking about doing business in the U.S.?
I guess any international companies, should take a closer look at their privacy and data protection laws. But again, I think the focus here was on the fact that the foreign company was a foreign adversary. It's not just that it's foreign. Court does clarify, of course, that to the extent the clarification was needed, and I think all the parties agreed that foreign companies or individuals, when their expression is abroad, are not protected by the First Amendment. So if you have something, some kind of situation in which it is a foreign media company, but the expressive activity is not occurring in the United States, then it's really not a First Amendment question at all.
Okay. Were there any arguments you were surprised to see come up at not an oral argument, in the decision?
I don't think so. I think for folks who listened to the oral argument, the decision kind of tracked which way the court was going to rule. I think, they were focused on the data protection rationale, skeptical of the covert content manipulation. There was a lot of funny exchanges about, to the extent it was covert before, now everybody knows. Everybody knows China's manipulating the content. So is that really a good justification? And one thing I was surprised was I think it was Justice Gorsuch had argued or would ask petitioner's counsel about, had asked the government's counsel, was arguing about the rationale for covert content manipulation and saying, pressing counsel, isn't that kind of a paternalistic idea? Why is it okay for the government to kind of say, hey, TikTok user, you know that you're putting your data out there. Why is that not your decision to control? And I was actually kind of surprised by that line of questioning, because I think in this situation, it's different, right? It's not just the user saying, okay, I consent to sharing my data. It's the national security rationale, where you're amassing so much data, and it's not just your own data. It's giving a foreign adversary control over your contacts, so other people's data, and you put that all information all together, not just from TikTok, but all the other sources, and it is a real national security issue. And that kind of, I think, goes against the paternalism arguments that usually I'm quite sympathetic to in another context.
Sounds good. Was there anything you were surprised not to see come up, especially given how our oral argument went?
I guess I was a little surprised that the court didn't, I don't know if it's surprised, but I think it's significant that the court declined to specifically rule. I mean, that whole first section of the opinion is dicta, essentially, on whether the First Amendment even applies here. So to the extent there is an analogous case down the road that you were asking about, like another foreign company with a social media application or other communication platform, to be seen of whether, the court decides that First Amendment scrutiny will even apply if you have those kind of limiting factors. And again, that causal chain, I think, is just got like a brief cursory a line in this decision. But I think it's something that the court has been grappling with in especially in this context of social media, where there are so many different players and the way that they interact, and trying to assess how a regulation impacts speech and what is the cause of that restriction. You know, sometimes it is just a direct regulation. The question is easy. But when it's not direct, when it's sort of an end run around, you know, government coercion or government compulsion of that speech, is that compulsion coming from the government or is it a third party? And so I think that's where we'll see a lot of litigation in the coming years about third parties' influence, you know, when you have like a more complicated causal relationship and the causal links that are needed to establish liability or, you know, invalidate a statute as government action.
Got it. Speaking to the potential uniqueness of this case, on the subject of amici, how usual is it for an incoming president to request the Supreme Court pause a decision pending an attempt at diplomacy? And how does that play into the separation of powers conversation that's also implicated by this case?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's ever happened before. I think it's definitely unique to this case, or is it? It could be. Maybe there's some historical analog that I'm just not familiar with. But you know, I don't think that's. I think that's just you know, part and parcel of it's an unprecedented administration as well. So I think President Trump certainly hasn't been shy about, you know, voicing his concerns or his opinions. And so, you know, prides himself on being a deal maker. So I don't think we're surprised at him trying to reach out and carve out one more deal. I guess I'm pleased that the court took up the case and didn't kind of take a side detour out, given that it was such a limited ruling. I mean, it could have had the potential to do a lot of mischief and undermine the First Amendment protections in ways. But I think that it's a very limited cabin decision.
Got it. Well, I will pose a last question, and barring any audience questions, maybe we'll get out of here a tad early. Now that we have the decision, what questions remain unanswered? I know we've flagged is this even a First Amendment thing? What happens when you have both content neutral and content specific justifications for something, and the level of scrutiny that may or may not apply? But what other questions are sort of percolating in the background as we walk away with the decision?
On a doctrinal note, I think those are probably the big ones. I guess as a practical note, there's a lot of percolating questions about what's the practical effect of this and what's going to happen on Sunday and thereafter. So, you know, I don't want to say that the incoming president, I guess they could, if there is some deal to be worked out or whatever, maybe this is all becomes a little bit academic, but eventually, you know, if Even under the Trump administration, they were concerned about the data sensitivity and all of that. So unless that's going to be resolved, I would think, you know, there still has to be some kind of divestiture or some kind of way to protect that data, even under a deal. So I guess to be seen.
Fair enough. Well, thank you. Thank you. Really appreciate you spending this portion of your afternoon and spending your morning reading the decision just after it dropped. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. I welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, we can wrap early. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.